Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, your host, and I'm joined today by Marius Ruart.
How's it, Nick?
And Sarah Gahn.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Marius.
So the first thing I just want to talk about very briefly is a little bit of news. We're not really going to have much to say on it. We will talk a little bit about the UK later. But Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, has apparently been hospitalized and has had some tests done on him relating to his COVID infection. He's had symptoms for, I think, around 10 days. And his doctors advised him to go and be tested in the hospital. So he says that he's still running the country and in charge of things, and that he's basically working from his hospital bed, but he is currently undergoing tests. So that's the first piece of news. The second piece of news is that News 24 had made a bit of a mistake. So a couple of days ago, on the 4th, they printed a story, or they put up a story online about Bill Gates potentially testing a vaccine for coronavirus in South Africa. And then over the weekend, they had to do a retraction for this. What exactly happened here, Marius?
So from what I can tell, is what happened is that an article was on News 24, and the headline and I think the first line of the article said, Bill Gates has said he wants to test this COVID vaccine in Africa. Then they shared a tweet that the presidency had posted to an interview between Bill Gates and Trevor Noah. In this interview, Bill Gates was talking about how he wants to help Africa with fight COVID and in it, you know, supplying testing kits and funds and so on. Nowhere does he talk about vaccines or anything like that. But that was what the story said, the first couple of lines of the story. And it seems this thing went kind of viral on Twitter. And, you know, people then all came out and said, no, Bill Gates is whatever, part of the Illuminati or it's a scam to try, you know, reduce the population of black people and of Africans and all this kinds of nonsense. And they used a kind of out of context a quote from Bill Gates where he was doing a TED talk and he said, if you vaccinate people, you reduce the population. What he meant was that by that was when people in poorer places generally have more kids because their kids got a far smaller chance of surviving to adulthood. But if kids are born and they got access to vaccines and good nutrition and good healthcare and so on, people are happy to have two or three kids because those kids are probably going to live to adulthood. But obviously, if you live in a very poor place like whatever, South Sudan or Mauritania or some Central African Republic, people there have still a very large number of kids. I mean, the fertility rate there is like 5 or 6 kids per woman because people, you know, it's people want to have kids. They know that your kids got a fairly quite a low chance of making it to puberty compared to you know, more developed places. So I mean, just that's what like was completely taken out of context is quotes on vaccines, and then obviously now this is linked to all kinds of conspiracy theories. Andile Lungisa, the crazy ANC counselor down in Nelson Mandela Bay, was saying this is obviously you know, evidence of a big conspiracy and that so on, and it just got a bit out of hand. So News 24 basically had to print a retraction after getting huge blowback from more sensible people on Twitter saying this is a terrible, you can't, this is not true, this is not happening. You're effectively spreading fake news, which is very dangerous in the current environment. So they've released an apology now and they've unpublished that article, if that's a word, on the News 24 site. So, but I mean,
what I don't understand about News 24 in that case is that, was it misinterpretation? Was it just sort of making it up as it went along?
I'm going to be charitable and just think it was a little mistake. Somebody went, they didn't think it through properly. They said, they listened to what Bill Gates said and for whatever reason they were in a rush or they just didn't think it through properly. Said he's going to test a vaccine instead of, or maybe they'd heard he was going to test a vaccine or something and they didn't check if he actually said that in the clip. And, you know, I'm going to, but I've seen all kinds of people now saying that Adrian Besson, who's the editor of News 24, must resign and the journalist who wrote this article must resign, which is all ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't done on purpose. That's a very big mistake, but I don't think anybody has to lose their jobs over this. Just learn from this, you know, especially if anybody needs to get into trouble, it needs to be somebody like Adrian Besson, not the journalist who wrote the article. It's probably some junior who's, you know, probably just out of varsity. You know, is it really going to be, you know, like to throw this person to the wolves? Somebody called him Klein Klein Jaylee, I think the name was. But I mean, you know, is that going to benefit anybody if this person gets fired? But I mean, what do you do? I mean, News 24 obviously has to get some sanctions because, I mean, as I say, spreading fake news in the current environment, especially with something as important as people's health, is quite a dangerous thing to do.
So what's quite interesting to me about this article is it's of a kind of genre that a lot of that I really despise, which is the people on Twitter are angry about X. And it always inflates stories completely beyond anything. It always drives outrage mobs, and it's essentially contentless. And I'm actually reading through the story now again, and it's just the headline is not really referenced properly in the text. It's sort of alluded to in the first line, but there's no quote, there's no clear connection between these two or evidence for it. It's a shockingly written story. And it's also got this weird sort of racial undertone to it. So it's basically feeding the worst kind of the sort of EFF, black first, land first type of racial paranoia about how the West is all going to poison black Africans with vaccines, and it's all just a scam to exploit money out of people. I must say, I do take a little bit less of a charitable view of this than you do, Marius, because I think that this kind of reporting is actually, it's very dangerous. It doesn't add anything to the public debate. And it's really, it's stirring a sort of a racial pot and clickbait at the same time. It's just awful. I mean, Sara, is there any redeeming quality to this kind of journalism?
I tend to take the sort of line you would take, and that is that, you know, we have problem enough in the media, particularly with the sort of free-for-all that is social media. It's literally a required of journalism that it tries, if not always succeed, but it certainly tries to achieve high ethical standards. And this looks like no one at the senior level looked at it.
One thing that's quite funny for me today, I was looking at News 24, and one of their main articles was how to spot fake news in the coronavirus crisis.
But of course, the editor has been very busy on Twitter, Adrian Basson, doing something else.
Yeah, so he tweeted the other day photos of some people walking. He looks like he lives in Sea Point in Cape Town, and he posted some photos of people running on the beach or walking to the shops and so on. And I mean, it's a big question, you know. Like Nick Bauer also tweeted a photo of a guy going for a run in Sandton, and you know, obviously according to the restrictions, people aren't allowed to. And Tom Eaton also tweeted something about people walking their dogs. Of course, you can't walk your dogs and go for a run and so on during these restrictions. But I mean, you've got to ask yourself now: is it a journalist's place to go, you know, try and enforce these laws? Are journalists supposed to be prefects or whatever? And you know, like kind of for me, it's kind of the same WhatsApp group as that Hungarian journalist. Their name escapes me now, but it was in 2015, I think, where they were covering a story of migrants who were coming into Hungary. And these migrants were running to try to get away from the police. And a journalist actually tripped one of the migrants. So the guy, chap fell and obviously could get caught by the cops. And, you know, for me, like, a journalist is there to document what's going on. They're not supposed to be getting involved with what's happening, you know. Unless they're going to admit to being embedded with the government or whatever the case is. And just one funny thing I saw. So Adrian Basson tweets about this guy and his girlfriend or wife or whatever walking down the road with a plastic pack, and says, and he Adrian Basson in the tweet, he says, these people carrying a shopping bag pretending they're going to the shop so they can get out. And then a guy, he says, that was me, you prick. I was walking to the shops. So I was getting anti-teething powder for my son, you knob. You know, so just how funny. Like, and it seems Adrian Basson was just sitting in his car.
Very much in a shopping bag.
Exactly. And it seems like Adrian Basson was actually sitting in his car and shouting at people saying, it's lockdown, go home. Which, I'm sorry, like, he's got no place to do that. It's same as the EFF saying they're going to go shut down businesses that break lockdown. They don't have any legal or moral authority to do it. That's really... You know, it's showing that there's this real authoritarian streak in the media and amongst South Africans in general, actually.
It's not only South Africa. I mean, the Brits, they've been complaining of that sort of thing as well. You know, the sort of busybodies looking out of their windows and then phoning the police. There's something particularly distasteful about it, because certainly if you see a group of 50 people gathering at the foreshore having a prayer meeting, by all means call the police. But, you know, it to some extent, it speaks to not just the personalities, and I think Nikolaus Bauer has joined that group as well, of the ENCA, but it also it speaks to a sort of a lack of empathy in a time in which information keeps changing, opinions on how we should deal with this keep changing, and we're sitting at home, and every now and again we're going to do something not very smart, like our colleague, and you know. It's very unpleasant. You're going to look at people who did that in a very skeptical way in future.
Exactly, and also as people get on their moral high horse, and I mean, as like you can't get COVID or pass it on if you're walking your dog by yourself. It's impossible, you know.
What really concerns me here is so I come from a family of journalists, and I've always had this vision in my mind of a journalist as something a little bit like our colleague Gabriel Krauser, sort of slightly unkempt, very rebellious attitude, you know, doesn't really like authority, very kind of a free spirited sort of person.
He's caught in a police block on his way back from Joburg to
an interview, which we talked about on our podcast.
In about 2 years.
Yes, which we talked about in our podcast, Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree. But what seems to be happening here is it seems like the forefront of our journalists are kind of salivating at the prospect of being able to tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. And one gets a horrible image of people in high school telling on students who are not doing exactly as the teacher wants. And it's very disturbing to me because I feel like they would that they would endorse brutal authoritarianism as long as it was something they agreed with. I you know, we don't know that for sure yet, but it's not a good sign.
With Besson, one thing that I thought was very hypocritical, somebody said to him, what were you doing outside then if, you know, during lockdown? He said, I'm an essential worker. And sure, journalists are essential workers, but you, the editor, you don't need to be out on the beat looking for stories and so on. It's like, if you say couriers now are essential workers, is the CEO of Ram Couriers, can he then walk around and say, well, he's an essential worker? No, of course not. You can do your job sitting at home, answering emails or phoning people, or whatever the case is. You don't have to be out in the streets. You're actually now misusing the privilege or the definition of essential worker. And I think it's just it shows quite a lot of hypocrisy.
There's a very uncomfortable close relationship right now between government and the big media houses that I think you're talking about there, and it really disturbs me. Anyway, let's move on to the UK, where the Labour Party, which just suffered one of its worst election defeats in decades, has appointed a new leader to replace outgoing leader Jeremy Corbyn, who led the party to that disastrous defeat. He's a guy called Keir Starmer. Sara, what should we know about him? What's he like?
Well, he's tall. That much I seem to have got. He's also male, which is interesting because there was a lot of debate about whether the next Labour leader should in fact be a woman. There were two women in the sort of final candidates list. But at the end of the day, they went for Sir Keir Starmer. He does have a title. But he's more of a, he seems to be in Labour Party terms, more of a centrist, and that seems to have been a defeat for the sort of Corbyn faction or the Momentum faction of the Labour Party. So where he'll go and how tough he will be in changing direction, I do not know at this stage.
I think one thing that's interesting is that the fact that the Labour Party has never elected a woman. So if you listen to identity politics people, then you probably think that the Labour Party is institutionally misogynistic.
Isn't that an irony?
I wonder how much opportunity he's going to have to really sort of turn around some of the Labour Party's ideas, because ideologically it looks like the battle is still dominated by the Momentum Jeremy Corbyn faction, even though they led the party to such a disastrous defeat. I mean, people have been talking about, you know, sort of Blairism, and I think one of you described him as being a Blairite. But you know, in the Labour Party, that's nowadays a swear word. So if you're not even able to talk about the most successful Labour leader in decades as a sort of positive character, I really am skeptical of your ability to change things in the party.
There was somebody, I can't remember who, but there was somebody fairly fairly prominent in the Labour Party. It was an Asian woman, quite young, I think. I can't remember her name now. And she said there'd been 40 years of Tory government in the UK. So she just decided to ignore the 13 years that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had been prime minister of the UK. Because obviously they weren't real Labour people, you know. They were like, you know, this kind of fake Labourites.
You know what's funny? Yeah. What's kind of funny about Keir Starmer is it's almost as if that he's so desperate to change. And he's starting to be competent. I don't take that away from him. But he looks so much like a Conservative Party MP.
But maybe that'll help him win, eh? Who knows?
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on now to home again, where our finance minister, Tito Mboweni, has talked about the need to revise the budget, which is, I think, something everyone expected. The economic fallout in South Africa and the world from COVID has been pretty disastrous, as far as we can tell. There's estimates that range from our economy shrinking anywhere from kind of around 2% to, you know, more than 10%. It's very difficult to really tell what the final number is going to be, but it's definitely going to be bad. So Tito's now saying, in line with this, we need to start cutting money from the budget expenditure and actually revising it. Maurice, what should the finance minister do? What are the opportunities here?
I'm going to be honest here, Nick, and tell you I've not followed this closely enough because I'm far too depressed to look at what the budget is and what it can be done. I saw the story and I was like, I don't even want to read this because I'm going to be too...
But in broad strokes.
Yeah, well, I think there's probably an opportunity here for a bit of reform, which we've been calling for a while. But I mean, who knows if this opportunity will be taken. I think one thing we've realized with Cyril Ramaphosa is he's a fellow who never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And we saw it. I mean, there was all this kind of goodwill around him when he became president in the beginning of 2018. Then again, when he won an election in his own right in 2019, and now in this crisis, if you really, and he's actually, I mean, to be honest, apart from some of his underlings like Fikile Mbalula and Becky Cele, I think the president himself and Zweli Mkhize, the health minister, have actually been, have really come to the party and have like shown real leadership in this crisis. And you feel that there's actually a steady hand on the tiller, not so much, as I say, when Mbalula and Cele are talking press conferences, but in Zweli Mkhize and Ramaphosa, you feel like things are under control and the country might be able to get through this in one piece. So, I mean, this is kind of an opportunity for reform to happen, I think. But, I mean, who knows if it'll happen. I mean, I'd say if you're a betting man, you'd probably say no.
Ramaphosa says that Ramaphosa has received Mboweni's approach and proposals, and they're considering them seriously. But I go with Maurice's point that, I mean, for me, you know, Ramaphosa has been better than bad, but he's dealing with the crisis has largely been about letting other people get on with it, which is in itself not a bad thing. But he looks presidential. But every single time he has mentioned the word reform in any context, we've ended up going in the opposite direction. I agree. I think Zweli Mkhize has handled the crisis well. My concern is that he is a very dogged proponent of the NHI, and that somehow he'll find the support he's getting in this regard as the basis for somehow going ahead with NHI properly or improperly. But I mean, look, if Mboweni is going to change the budget, those SOEs have got to, the bulk of them have to go. That is just money flushed down the toilet. Of course, the scary thing is having to reallocate money from other needy areas in order to cope with the crisis economically and health-wise.
Yeah, there's a lot that can be done and must be done if we're to recover from the state we're in. I mean, a lot of the sort of more ideological projects of the ANC really need to be tossed out. They were unaffordable before, and now they are beyond unaffordable. If the economy doesn't rocket back up once we get out of this, we are going to be in for a decade of misery.
And that means we're going to have 20 lost years, actually. We add the Zuma years, we add the Ramaphosa years, and who knows how big our economy could have been if we'd carried on the path we were at the end of Mbeki's presidency. And now how many more people could have been out of not been living in poverty? How many more kids have got decent education? How many people... intergenerational poverty, how much of that would have been reduced and so on. You know, but if we have another 10 years of this, it's 20 lost years. And I mean, of course, like, you know, nothing's, I mean, we can always get out of it. But, you know, if we, another 20 years of being stuck in this, it's going to take South Africa that much longer to become, you know, a country where, with reduced levels of poverty and so on. You know, if we, that's just, yeah, it's just, it's, it makes one despair when you think about what could be coming in the next 10 years, Paul.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, essentially, it's about it requires the ANC to do a complete U-turn ideologically.
Thing is, I mean, there's a precedent for it in the ANC. I mean, 1991, as our CEO, Frans Grenier, always likes to talk about, where Nelson Mandela effectively unilaterally decided that the ANC was going to turn away from nationalization and communism and so on, and decided to embrace free market politics. So, I mean, it's not impossible that this could happen again. It just depends we assume that Cyril Ramaphosa is actually a reformer, and say he is a reformer, which is a bit of an assumption. If he does have the testicular fortitude to actually take on the lefties and the looters who are in the ANC, I mean, does he have the kind of authority that Nelson Mandela did to... and how you did in the 90s and Thabo Mbeki as well in the mid-90s where you decided to implement gear. Not sure if Cyril Ramaphosa has got the authority or if he's got the standing in the party or if himself just has the guts to do it.
I think he's going to be tested relatively soon on this because the unions have shown themselves to be utterly and totally inflexible in even thinking about any kind of negotiation on wages, even above inflation wage increases. So if he can crack some of those deals and force the unions to pull back a bit, I think it'll be a very good sign. But
unions have got, they have no regard for the country whatsoever.
No, none at all. Completely irresponsible claims. The last thing I wanted to talk about, a little bit of a more uplifting thing. Now, there's a couple of us in the organization who are quite a fan of the English royal family. Some of us who are not fans of the English royal family as well. But I count myself as a fan, along with our colleague Herman Pretorius. And the Queen Elizabeth, Queen of the United Kingdom and of the Commonwealth, gave a speech last night, which I listened to. It was, I thought, very uplifting. Did you guys hear it? Or and if so, no. What were your thoughts?
I'm a Republican, Nick. I didn't listen to it.
Okay, well then.
I'm joking, but I didn't listen.
I watched it and I listened, and it was interesting on two levels. One is that she looked very composed, very together, very in charge, despite the fact that she's a very old lady and she's a small woman. But she had the authority and she was speaking with authority. It's not that the content of the speech itself was that it was uplifting. It was meant to be encouraging, but she could talk from, and she did talk from the experience of having spoken to the nation as a 14-year-old during the Blitz. And the interesting thing about that was it's a nice historical reference point. It's also a case of, guys, however bad you think it is now, by implication, it was much worse then. And I think that all around had quite a nice, there was a dignity about it that I think few could fault.
I think there are very few world figures who have her sort of ability to, she really understands what it means to be a modern monarch. She very nicely keeps above the fray in a lot of political discussions, and she deploys herself very rarely. And when she does, though, she's managed to completely perfect the sort of stage art of appearing to be this, like, almost mystical, powerful figure, even though she's a small German woman who's very old and belongs to a completely ancient, archaic, outdated institution.
Despite that.
But yes, I thought it was a very nice thing to hear. Of course, I made the mistake of looking to Twitter replies of her speech, and they were, as one expected, not overflowing with the milk of human kindness.
Or graciousness, I imagine.
No, but if you look beyond that, you can. There are few figures in the world who are sort of both inoffensive and also as charming, I think.
Mm.
And so I was very pleased to hear that speech.
Yeah, it's a certain level of authoritativeness that you kind of do respect her, whatever your feelings may be. She's a respectable person.
I think that's what the royal family's been very lucky that they've had somebody like that at its head for so long. I mean, Prince Charles is a bit of an eccentric, and you know, he got up to no good in the 80s with, you know, cheated on Princess Diana and so on. And I think William seems like a steady hand, but I mean, if something had to happen to him. Because if Harry became, we'd have like this woke monarch. I mean, with the even woke consorts, it'd be something times the royal family. So as I say, I think the British royal family's been very lucky to have Queen Elizabeth at its head for so long.
And I think when she passes away, she will be missed. By them for sure, and probably by a lot of people around the world. Anyway, I think we'll call it to a draw or close there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for bearing with us in these difficult times. And thank you to those of you who have already become friends of the Institute. If you'd like to become a friend of the Institute, please go to our website and click Join Us. A small monthly donation a month, sort of 50 Rand or so, keeps us alive in the battle of ideas, keeps us providing that alternative voice and those policy ideas. And if you want to read our policy proposals to deal with COVID-19, go to our website. That's irr.org.za. Click reports, and it's the top one there, and give it a read. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you on the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend Show.